scene. Ayalon's musings about snakes and cutting off heads notwithstanding, it seemed increasingly clear that Hamas's leader would have to be neutralized. The Shin Bet and Seret Matkal collaborated on a complicated plan to abduct and imprison him, but that idea was dropped, because any such operation would almost certainly require a gunfight, and a gunfight meant that soldiers, civilian bystanders, or the Sheikh himself could be hit. It also wasn't at all clear that Sheikh Yassin's return to prison would even stop the suicide bombings. Israeli officials remembered that his long period of incarceration, which ended in the humiliating deal with King Hussein following the failed attempt to kill Khaled Mashal, had been rife with acts of murder and abductions by Hamas aimed at freeing him, along with waves of suicide bombings. The only effective way to deal with Yassin, many argued, was to kill him. But Israeli decision-makers were much more hesitant about pulling the trigger when it came to Yassin, despite the fact that everyone agreed that he was actively involved in directing and planning Hamas terror. True, Israel had nearly killed him the previous year during the Dream Team meeting, but that meeting included military operatives too. Assassinating him, and him alone, was a completely different matter. Sheikh Yassin was a founder of the Hamas movement, a political leader of world renown, and a religious figure accepted throughout the Middle East. In a discussion in November, Avi Dichter argued, "Assassinating this particular individual is liable to set the Middle East ablaze and bring upon us waves of terror from outside our borders." Major General Amos Gilad, Director of Policy and Political Military Affairs at the Ministry of Defense, was known for his hawkish views, but he also objected. "Sheikh Yassin is the exact paradigm of an ideologue of death, an architect of endless murder," he said. But he concurred with those who feared a conflagration across the entire Islamic world in response to the slaying of someone perceived as a Muslim spiritual leader. Ya'alon countered that Yassin was not seen as a spiritual leader, and killing him would not cause any response, beyond angry condemnation. "It's inconceivable that we should go in circles around him, killing everyone else," he said, "and not strike at him." Defense Minister Mafaz adopted an even harsher approach. "Not only must we hit him, but I also have no problem doing it with a high signature, that is, leaving no doubt that Israel had carried out the assassination." Although Sharon agreed in principle with Ya'alon and Mafaz, Dichter was his senior advisor on terrorism and targeted killings, and even the assertive Sharon seemed to have lost a bit of his confidence in light of the opposition from Dichter and others. Major General Giora Eiland raised an additional cause for worry. Bad PR. Was it not a problem for Israel to kill an elderly, pitiable, half-blind cripple in a wheelchair? Won't we look like the Wild West? Sharon was not really concerned, but he did ask to hear additional opinions. The IDF's philosopher-in-chief, Aza Kasher, supported Ya'alon. "The distinction between political and military echelons, fostered by international human rights organizations, would also have left Hitler immune to attack for a significant period of time. The distinction between the echelons is particularly dubious when it comes to terrorist organizations." On the other hand, the military advocate general was emphatically opposed. Since Finkelstein and Daniel Reisner formulated the rules for targeting killings 3 years earlier, Reisner and his staff had been present for many of the actions, providing legal backing for them. In some cases, they ordered the postponement of an operation out of fear of injuring innocents. In the case of Yassin, for the first time, their strong opposition stemmed from the identity of the targeted person. The growing importance accorded to Reisner's opinion was due partly to the establishment of the International Criminal Court during that period. Senior officials in Israel began to worry about being indicted for targeted killings and sought legal support. Nevertheless, Ya'alon persisted, and the matter was taken up with the Attorney General's office, the highest professional legal authority in Israel. It was the first time that the targeted killing of a specific person had come before this forum for discussion. Amman and Shin Bet officials brought with them the red page, all the evidence that had accumulated against Yassin, the founding of Hamas, virulent preaching against the existence of Israel, establishment of the terrorist apparatus, prior convictions on charges of ordering the abduction and murder of Israeli soldiers in the 1980s, acquisition of weaponry, fundraising for military activities, advocacy of suicide terror, and more. Finkelstein and Reisner argued that, with all due respect to the Red Page, targeted killings were not meant to be carried out as revenge or punishment, but only in order to prevent a future attack. There was no recent indication in the intelligence material that Yassin was involved directly in terror. "But that's because he knows we are keeping close track of him," argued an Amman representative. "Therefore, he's being very careful not to say anything on the telephone or via any other electronic means." Attorney General Eliakim Rubinstein endorsed the military advocate general's position and stated that he would not approve the assassination until clear-cut evidence was provided that linked Yassin directly to terror and that would stand up in court. Shortly thereafter, on January 14, 2004, a young woman from the Gaza Strip, 21 years old, tried to enter into Israel at the Erez crossing. She had to pass through a metal detector, like all Palestinians. There was a high, pinging beep, 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 beep when she went through the detector. "Platin, platin," she told the border guards, pointing at her leg, a platinum implant. The guards sent her through again, then a third time. The detector kept beeping. A female guard was summoned to frisk her. She then detonated a bomb that killed four examiners and wounded 10 other people. The woman's name was Reem Saleh Riashi. She had two children, one 3 years old, the other only 18 months. A day later, Sheikh Yassin called a press conference at the home of one of his followers. He sat in his wheelchair, wrapped in a brown blanket, with a large wreath in the form of a heart carrying the inscription Hamas in the background. He was smiling. "For the first time," he said, "we have used a woman fighter instead of a man. This is a new development in the struggle against the enemy." The Sheikh, who in the past had issued several fatwas, religious edicts, against the use of female suicide bombers, said he had changed his mind. "The holy war obligates all Muslims, men and women. This is proof that the resistance will continue until the enemy is driven out of our homeland." For Israel, such a shift in tactics was menacing. We asked ourselves, how will we be able to cope with waves of female suicide bombers coming into the country? Defense Minister Mofaz said. "There are standards of decorum, even in a dirty war. It is much harder to examine women and prevent explosives from being brought in." In addition to Yassin's statement, Amman was able to present Attorney General Rubinstein with transcripts of secret recordings made by 8200's Turban Base, of Yassin telling his operational staff that women could be used as suicide bombers. "We had clear intelligence-based evidence of the direct link between the political leadership of Hamas, headed by Sheikh Yassin, and the planners and executors of the terror attacks," said Farkash. Rubinstein was persuaded. Yassin could legally be killed. The security cabinet convened to decide. Shimon Peres was still opposed. "I feared that they would start trying to kill Israeli leaders," he later said. "I thought that it was precisely with him that we would be able to reach a peace agreement." But by a majority of one, the ministers determined that he was a terrorist leader. "I was not impressed by the warnings that the earth would tremble or the skies fall in because of this assassination," said Ehud Olmert, then the Minister for Trade, Industry, and Communications, who was part of the majority. In a procedure that had already become routine, the cabinet left it up to Sharon and Mofaz to approve the proposals of the IDF and Shin Bet concerning when and how to carry out the hit. Sharon's aides told U.S. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice that Yassin had become a legitimate target from Israel's point of view. A pretty tough argument ensued, Weissglass said. They were worried there'd be a general flare-up in the Middle East. In public appearances, Sharon also dropped hints that he now saw Yassin as a target. This only led to a tightening of the security around the Hamas leader. He stayed home, emerging only to visit a mosque and his sister's home, both of which were near his house. Movement between the three points was in two vans, one equipped with a lift for Yassin's wheelchair, while his armed bodyguards traveled in the second. His life was confined to this triangle, and he and his people assumed that Israel would not dare strike at any of its vertices, each of which was crowded with women and children and, in the case of the mosque, innocent civilians. But there were spaces in between those three points. On the evening of March 21, Yassin was driven to prayers at the mosque, his bodyguards following in a second van. Mufaz ordered that both vehicles be destroyed on their way back. There were choppers in the air and UAVs buzzing overhead, and Yassin's son, Abd al-Hamid, had been around long enough to sense the danger. He raced to the mosque. "Father, do not leave here," he warned. "They, the Israelis, will not attack a mosque." The sheikh and his bodyguards decided to be cautious and remain in the mosque. Hours went by. The JWR and all the forces remained on alert, with the Air Force keeping shifts of drones and attack helicopters in the air, relieving them when they ran out of fuel. The sheikh went to sleep on a mattress on the floor of the mosque, waking up early because it was uncomfortable. After the dawn prayers, he wanted to go home. "Helicopters could not be heard above," his son said. Everyone was sure the danger had passed. Still, it was a risk. To confuse the trackers, they decided to bundle the sheikh in his wheelchair and then run to his home. The van would only draw attention. "To tell the truth, I did not think they'd fire at a cripple's wheelchair," Hamid said. The trackers were still there, of course, the drones still watching through thermal imaging cameras. People came out the front door, moving quickly past the vans parked by the entrance, pushing a wheelchair. Air Force Commander Halutz could not authorize opening fire, because Defense Minister Mofaz's orders allowed him to fire only at the two vans. "Mr. Minister," Halutz said, "we do not have framing of the vans, but we do see a group of bodyguards running with a wheelchair and someone wearing a kafia in it. Do we have authorization?" Mofaz asked him to speak to the Apache pilot and ask him if he could clearly see the wheelchair and whether he could hit it. "I see them very clearly," the pilot said. "I can take them out." "I authorize," said Mufaz. "Rashai," Halutz radioed the pilot. On the video feed there was a flash, then a fraction of a second of blank screen. Then parts of the wheelchair flew in all directions, one wheel soaring upward and landing outside the frame, and people lying or crawling on the ground. "Request permission for supplements," the pilot said. "Permission granted," Mufaz answered. Another missile hit the ground, killing anyone who was still alive. Mufaz called Sharon, who was waiting tensely at his home on Sycamore Farm, for the outcome of the operation. "We have video," he said. "Judging by the pictures, it looks good. We hit the bullseye, but let's wait for reports from additional sources." Within a few minutes, the duty monitors at Turban reported that Hamas's communications channels were bursting with traffic. "Sheikh Yassin has become a shaheed, along with a number of his bodyguards," the organization's members were telling one another. "His son, Abd al-Hamid, was badly wounded." Sharon ordered that his staff be woken up to prepare to handle the fallout. News of the assassination was received with deep concern in Washington. "They're on the verge of hysteria," Weissglass reported to Sharon. He told Rice not to worry, that Israel expected the Arab world's response to be condemnation and nothing more. "Condi," he said, in his calm and persuasive voice, "even in the Palestinian Authority, we do not anticipate anything unusual. They have declared 3 days of national mourning, but all the stores are open. It's going to be all right. Once the days of national mourning ended, Hamas's supreme leadership body, the Shura Council, appointed Abd al-Aziz Rantisi to succeed Yassin. He was sworn in on a soccer field in one of the Gaza refugee camps. Sitting on a dais before a large crowd, the entire leadership of the organization watched a parade of uniformed militiamen and kissed the new leader's hand. "We'll fight the enemy everywhere. We'll teach it the meaning of resistance," Rantisi declared in his maiden speech, and he vowed to avenge the slaying of Yassin. The Israelis were aware of the plans for the parade and ceremony, but Sharon ordered the Shin Bet and the Air Force to hold their fire, for fear of hitting civilians, and because it was clear that foreign TV networks would be there and would broadcast any Israeli attack live. Nevertheless, by that point, Sharon had already authorized the new leader's assassination. This decision was much easier. Rantisi lacked Yassin's religious authority, and he wasn't an internationally recognized Arab political figure. His involvement in terror was indisputable and, most important, the precedent had been set. Now any Hamas leader could be liquidated. Rantisi was cautious and tried to be deceptive, squirreling from one hideout to another, wearing wigs and using different code names on his cell phones. But Turban had no difficulty keeping tabs on him. On April 17, only a couple of weeks after being placed in charge of Hamas, he went home to make the final arrangements for the marriage of his son, Ahmed. It was a brief visit. He gave his wife the cash she needed to complete the preparations, then he left. He was driving down Al-Jala Street when a brushlet missile exploded into his Subaru. A crowd of hundreds gathered around the charred remnants of the vehicle. A first aid team tried in vain to save the lives of Rantisi and the two aides who were with him. A photograph distributed by the Reuters agency showed the screaming and weeping crowd, with one man holding his hands, smeared with the blood of the dead leader, up to the sky. "He was a pediatrician who dealt mainly with the murder of children," Mufaz told the press. Associates of Sharon's made the implied warning explicit. "Arafat should take note," one said, "that anyone whose business is terror should be very wary of his fate." The killing of Rantisi was the 168th targeted killing operation since the beginning of the Intifada, in late 2000. By that point, Operation Picking Anemones had successfully thrown Hamas into a state of shock and confusion. The Shura Council immediately appointed a successor to Rantisi, but he was a minor figure, whose name was kept classified so that he wouldn't end up dead too. All of the senior Hamas officials took extreme measures to remain under Israel's radar, effectively spending most of their time just trying to stay alive. "The Zionist enemy has succeeded in assassinating many of the fighting brothers, and this at a time when we badly need each and every pure fighter," a declaration on the Hamas website stated. "There is no doubt at all that negligence is one of the main reasons for the enemy's success, because the electronic spy planes never leave the skies of Gaza. The many eyes assigned this task do not know sleep, and the Apache helicopters are ready and available with their missiles and waiting for the opportunity. You are a target for assassination every day, even every hour of the day." 2 weeks after Rantisi was killed, General Omar Suleiman, the Egyptian intelligence minister and the most powerful man in the Cairo regime after President Mubarak, went to Israel for an urgent meeting with Mufaz, Ya'alon, and Dikter. "I come with a message of conciliation," Suleiman said. He presented Hamas's proposal for a ceasefire, the gist of which was no assassinations, no terror attacks. Mufaz thanked Suleiman for coming. He told him that, as always, Egypt's efforts to bring about conciliation in the region were appreciated. But there was nothing more to discuss. Israel, he said, would not stop the targeted killings in general or the campaign to kill Hamas leadership in particular. Suleiman grew angry. "I came all the way from Cairo and bring you an offer to stop the attacks. This is what you wanted. Why are you persisting?" Hamas wants a truce so it can grow stronger, Mufaz said. We have to defeat them, not allow them to breathe. Suleiman appealed to Sharon, who greeted him warmly but yielded no ground. Our defense establishment's position is that we must not agree to a ceasefire, he said. I cannot oppose my own generals. He offered only that Israel would carefully monitor Hamas's conduct. Hamas activists tried to make it difficult for the Israeli drones and Apaches to find them. They moved only when necessary, used motorcycles, and tried to keep to narrow streets. It didn't matter. Two were killed by missiles in Gaza on May 30, and another was killed in the Balata refugee camp 2 weeks later. On that same day, Suleiman came to see Sharon in person again, after intensive phone communications that had taken place since the previous visit. Mr. Prime Minister, now you know their offer is serious, and they have ceased attacking. Grudgingly, Sharon agreed to stop the targeted killings. Hamas ordered an absolute and immediate cessation of suicide attacks. Ariel Sharon now had the upper hand in the fight against terror. During that period, when the security situation became a bit calmer, he even began to consider a political solution to the historic conflict in the Middle East. His close affinity to President Bush and the deep relationship he developed with the entire American administration, predicated upon the trade-off of freezing settlements in exchange for carte blanche and targeted killings, made Sharon come to feel that the Americans sincerely wanted to help the State of Israel, and gave him some new realizations. Sharon reached the conclusion that it doesn't matter who is sitting in the White House. They will always view the settlements as a significant problem, said Weissglass. And for Sharon, the settlements, which he had wholeheartedly promoted in his previous positions, were not a religious, ideological issue. Rather, they were a security consideration. The moment he understood that they're a burden and not an advantage, he had no problem evacuating them and turning his back on the settlers. Sharon, the sworn hawk, who had built his career on his aggressive policy toward the Arabs in general and the Palestinians in particular, underwent a dramatic change, Weissglass said. He wanted to exit the stage as a battle-worn general who became a great peacemaker. However, Sharon still believed that there was one key obstacle to achieving this vision, Yasser Arafat. The prime minister had come to accept that there was no way to preclude the creation of an independent Palestinian state, but this didn't decrease his loathing for their leader. He regarded Arafat as someone who had established a regime of terror in the territories he ruled, training terrorists in an organized and state-sponsored way, inciting, funding, equipping, and arming them, and dispatching them to kill throughout Israel. In a telephone conversation with Russian Defense Minister Sergei Ivanov, Sharon described Arafat as a pathological liar, a murderer who ordered the killing of children, women, and infants. Israeli intelligence received a large portion of Yasser Arafat's archives when IDF forces captured part of his headquarters near Ramallah, and this material provided hundreds of footnotes to Sharon's accusations. Arafat had ordered, in his own handwriting, the transfer of huge sums to support Fatah's terror activities. The Palestinian president and his circle were also involved in an unprecedented amount of corruption. The documents indicated that Arafat repeatedly reneged on his promises to Israel and the international community to build a true democratic state with a modern economy and a single armed force. He failed to make the transition from the head of a guerrilla organization to the leader of a democratic state, and continued to manage the Palestinian Authority with the same methods of manipulation, corruption, and divide and conquer he employed in managing the PLO. All with the goal of ensuring his survival as the Palestinian leader. As part of a plan to delegitimize Arafat, Sharon gave a few journalists, me and subsequently several non-Israeli journalists, access to these archives in order for them to be published throughout the world. He also gave a directive to transfer money from the Mossad director's secret fund in order to help with the overseas publication of a book about these documents. Sharon even considered disseminating a videotape filmed by Romanian intelligence in the late 1970s. General Ion Mihai Pacepa, the former head of DIE, the Soviet Romanian intelligence organization, who said of Arafat, "I have never seen so much cleverness, blood, and abomination combined in one man," recalled that his men had installed hidden cameras in the official guest house where Arafat stayed after meeting with President Nicolae Ceaușescu, and that these cameras documented Arafat engaging in homosexual relations with his bodyguards. Sharon told his aides that this documentation had reached the hands of Israeli intelligence and that he considered disseminating it anonymously on the internet. Sharon dropped this distasteful idea when Israel achieved its objective through other means, by convincing the American administration that Arafat was incorrigible. Israel acquired unequivocal proof of Arafat's involvement in smuggling weaponry on the Karine A ship from Iran to terror groups in the Palestinian Authority. After Flotilla 13 and Operation Noah's Ark seized control of the ship at sea, and its crew was arrested and interrogated, implicating a close associate of Arafat's, the president of the Palestinian Authority denied that he or any of his staff were involved in a special letter to President Bush. However, intelligence information, including wiretaps, documents, and interrogation transcripts, taken to the White House by a senior Amman officer in a briefcase chained to his wrist, was much more convincing. When Bush learned that Arafat had brazenly lied to him, he declared the Palestinian president irrelevant and on June 24, 2002, called upon the Palestinian people to elect a new leader. In November 2002, in the wake of several horrific attacks against Israelis, Sharon gave an order to encircle the Mukatta, Arafat's headquarters, and to leave Arafat and some of his men besieged inside. His instructions were to make life miserable for the dog from the Mukatta, as he called him, sometimes cutting off electricity, sometimes cutting off the water supply. Sharon then ordered a company of armored D-9 bulldozers to demolish another wall of the compound every few days. Even still, there were disagreements about what finally should be done with Arafat. Some thought he should be made a target for liquidation and that Israel should strike against him. Some thought he should be hit covertly, without connecting the action to Israel. Others were in favor of exiling him, while some said he should be left alone to rot in the Mukatta. After a grave attack in April 2002, Sharon and Chief of Staff Mofaz were overheard conducting a private conversation. They sat near microphones at a public event, unaware that a television crew was already connected to the microphones and was filming them from afar. "Mofaz, we've got to get rid of him." "Sharon, what?" "Mofaz, to get rid of him." "Sharon, I know." "Mofaz, to take advantage of the opportunity now. There won't be another opportunity. I want to talk with you now." "Sharon, when we act." "I don't know what method you use for this," chuckles, "but you put everyone to sleep," becomes serious. "We have to be careful." It is unclear precisely which act Sharon was referring to here, but the IDF and the intelligence community did prepare contingency plans for each potential Arafat strategy. The command of the Air Force, Dan Halutz, who was an enthusiastic proponent of exiling Arafat, picked out two small islands, one near the coast of Lebanon and the other near Sudan, as potential new homes for the president. In his view, Arafat should be dispatched there with two aides and a little food and water for the trip, and then Israel would announce his whereabouts to the world. Special infantry units were slated to seize the Mukatta and proceed to Arafat's room. Israel considered launching sleeping gas into the compound prior to the raid in order to spare lives. Ultimately, the operation was canceled because "we couldn't ensure that Arafat would come out of all this alive," recalled the head of the trauma unit of the medical corps, Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Amir Blumenfeld. After all, we were dealing with an old man who had lots of medical problems, and with the possibility of a battle erupting with the soldiers who came to abduct him. The deliberations surrounding Arafat eventually reached Washington. Bush administration officials feared that, just as Sharon had decided to liquidate Yassin, he would also order the assassination of Arafat. In a meeting at the White House on April 14, 2004, Bush demanded that Sharon promise not to harm Arafat. According to one of the participants in the meeting, Sharon told the president that he understood his request. I see your point. Bush saw that the prime minister was prevaricating, and he pressed on until Sharon explicitly promised not to kill Arafat. Even before this promise, Sharon, in consultation with the heads of the IDF and the intelligence community, had reached the conclusion that Israel must not be seen as being involved in the death of Yasser Arafat in any way. This became even more important after he made the promise to President Bush. And then, suddenly, the man who had managed to elude death so many times succumbed to a mysterious intestinal disease and died. Laboratory tests conducted at the initiative of various parties came to different conclusions. According to some tests, there were traces of polonium, a radioactive material used in assassinations, on Arafat's clothes and remains. Other experts determined that he had died a natural death. Arafat's medical file from the French military hospital near Paris, where Sharon permitted him to be flown so that he wouldn't die in an area under Israeli control, raises many questions and does not rule out the possibility that he died from AIDS. Israeli spokespersons categorically denied that Israel was in any way involved in Arafat's death. "We didn't kill Arafat," senior members of the intelligence community and political echelon have solemnly repeated. On the other hand, there is no doubt that the timing of Arafat's death was quite peculiar, coming so soon after the assassination of Yassin. In his book, Ariel Sharon, An Intimate Portrait, Yuri Dan, Sharon's loyal spokesman, claimed that in a later meeting with Bush, Sharon said that he no longer considered himself bound to his earlier promise not to kill Arafat, and that the president offered no response. During that period, Dan complained to Sharon, asking why he didn't exile Arafat or put him on trial. "So Arafat has complete immunity?" Sharon responded tersely, "Let me do things my way." Dan then noted, "Suddenly he cut off our conversation. Something unusual in the relations between us." Dan went on to say that Arafat's condition began to deteriorate after that meeting with the president, and concluded by stating, "Ariel Sharon will appear in the history books as the one who wiped out Arafat without killing him." If I knew the answer to the question of what killed Yasser Arafat, I wouldn't be able to write it here in this book, or even be able to write that I know the answer. The military censor in Israel forbids me from discussing this subject. One can say with certainty that Sharon wanted to get rid of Arafat, whom he saw as a two-legged beast and whom he had failed to kill 20 years earlier. If Sharon indeed ordered Arafat's liquidation, it was done in utmost secrecy, in much smaller forums than with any other targeted killing. Sharon himself defined the goal of such an operation without admitting it. "Recent events are likely to be a historical turning point," he said in a special statement following Arafat's death. "If, after the Arafat era, a different, serious, responsible leadership emerges, one that carries out its undertakings, a fair opportunity will arise to coordinate various moves with that leadership, and even to resume diplomatic negotiations with it." Without acknowledging direct involvement in Arafat's death, all of the senior echelon during that period agreed that the removal of Arafat improved Israel's security. Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, who was appointed to replace him as president, and the new Palestinian prime minister, Salam Fayyad, who had close ties to the American administration, launched a determined campaign against terror. Even the skeptical heads of the Shin Bet admit that the Palestinians became serious about stopping terrorism after the arrival of Abbas and Fayyad. and that the quiet achieved since Arafat's death is due largely to the close security cooperation with the two of them. The war between Israel and the Palestinians that broke out in September 2000, a war of continual retaliations of suicide bombings and targeted killings, gradually subsided until it stopped altogether. Israel deployed a number of measures in its war against Palestinian terror in the Second Intifada, including IDF ground forays to conduct extensive arrests and the construction of a barrier between the West Bank and Israel that made it more difficult for suicide terrorists to enter into Israel. But while these measures somewhat hampered the terror organizations, statistics clearly show that they continued their attempts to execute murderous terror attacks after those measures were initiated, and that the terror attacks ceased only after a massive number of targeted killings of terrorist operatives and, in Operation Picking Anemones, the assassination of terrorist leaders. Thanks to its streamlined targeted killing apparatus, the Israeli intelligence community triumphed over something that for many years had been considered unbeatable: suicide terrorism. By investing the resources of an entire country, through dogged persistence and cooperation between the intelligence and operational arms, and under the decisive leadership of Ariel Sharon, Israel proved that a murderous and seemingly uncompromising terror network can be brought to its knees. The use of targeted killings, however, had heavy concomitant costs. The price was paid first and foremost by the innocent Palestinians, who became the coincidental damage of the assassinations. Many innocent people were killed, and thousands, including many children, were wounded and left disabled for life. Others were mentally scarred or homeless. A high-ranking Shin Bet officer said, "In the past, when it was all secret and of dubious legality, we could carry out very few hits. How many of these can be done without getting exposed? The minute the IDF Advocate General made these actions kosher, legal, and overt, we opened up an assembly line for assassinations. So now our consciences are cleaner, but a lot more folks ended up dead." Gabriela Bloom, as of 2018, a law professor at Harvard, was an officer in the IDF Military Advocate General's Corps and one of the authors of the memorandum that legalized assassinations. Commenting in 2017, she expressed her serious regrets. "I am deeply concerned that what was originally authorized as an exceptional act to be taken in exceptional cases became a regular practice." The targeted killing campaign also did a great deal to further marginalize and delegitimize Israel in the eyes of the world. David was once again behaving like Goliath. Chief of Staff Dan Halutz tried to explain why Israel adopted its targeted killing policy. "This is the basic code of conduct in the Middle East. They realized that we are insane, that we are ready to go all the way, that we would not be prepared to swallow anymore." Yet, although the deaths of two high-ranking figures, Yassin and Arafat, certainly had a dramatic impact on the region, Ami Ayalon was right when he said that while assassinating leaders was likely to divert history onto a new course, it would not necessarily be a better one than the previous path. It might very well be one that ends up prolonging the amount of time before peace is attained. As it turned out, Arafat was the only person able to keep the Palestinian people united, more or less, under the PA's control. After his demise, President Abbas failed in this regard, and Hamas took over Gaza and established a second Palestinian entity there. This new arrangement constituted a grave threat to Israel, a threat much greater than Arafat ever was. Hamas succeeded in gaining control of Gaza thanks to the enormous assistance it received from Iran. Paradoxically, it is hard to believe that Hamas would ever have succeeded in establishing a state of its own in the Gaza Strip if Sheikh Yassin was still alive. Yassin strongly opposed any cooperation or ties with Iran, and he imposed his view on the organization. Undoubtedly, the killing of Sheikh Yassin was the harshest blow suffered by Hamas in its entire history, and the single biggest factor in its desire to reach a ceasefire with Israel. But it also led to another unlikely twist in the course of Middle East history. Thanks to Yassin's removal from the scene, Iran, Israel's most dangerous enemy, forged the last link in its plan to become a regional power. Chapter 33. The Radical Front. Leadership came unexpectedly to Bashar al-Assad. Hafez al-Assad, who seized control of Syria in November 1970, had expected his eldest son, Basil, to succeed him, but he was killed in a car crash. Assad's second choice was his youngest son, Maher, who had chosen a military career, but he proved too hot-headed, inclined to fits of rage and violent outbursts. A third son, Majid, suffered from a congenital disease which later killed him. That left Bashar, who was 29 years old and in London, doing postgraduate training in ophthalmology, when his father summoned him back to Damascus right after Basil's fatal accident in 1994. Bashar had always been considered the weakest of the Assad sons, somewhat aloof and dreamy, appearing a little intimidated. His father may have been aware of Bashar's weaknesses, but his concern about the family's continued rule was his top priority. He sent Bashar to the military, where he quickly rose to the rank of colonel, then appointed him commander of the Syrian forces in Lebanon for seasoning. By the end of the 1990s, Bashar was well-groomed for the presidency. Hafez al-Assad died in June 2000. Bashar was elected president the next month. But Assad's inheritance was, at that precise moment, a problematic one. The Soviet Union had dissolved a decade earlier, the Cold War was over, and Russia at that time wasn't nearly as influential in the Middle East as it had been. The global stage was being reset, and Bashar al-Assad had to find Syria's place on it. The Syrian economy, however, was in worse shape than ever. The state's coffers were empty, and its army, though one of the largest in the region, was partly outdated and in urgent need of modern weaponry. Most important, Israel still held the Golan Heights, captured from Syria in 1967. It was a deep and open wound, and national pride would not allow it to clot. In the middle of 2000, Assad had a choice: to align Syria with the United States, the last remaining superpower, or with Iran, the emerging regional power. This was not a difficult decision. 10 years before he died, President Hafez al-Assad had stunned the world by agreeing to join the alliance the United States forged against another Arab state to expel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. He hoped for something in return: economic benefits, removal of Syria from the list of states involved in terrorism and the drug trade, and pressure on Israel to completely withdraw from the Golan Heights. He received none of these. 3 months before he died, Hafez al-Assad met with President Bill Clinton in Geneva, the climax of an American diplomatic effort to broker a peace accord between Syria and Israel. Clinton brought a message to Assad from Prime Minister Ehud Barak that included the best offer he had ever received from Israel: a nearly complete withdrawal from the Golan Heights, except that no Syrian soldiers would splash their feet in the waters of the Sea of Galilee. That is, there would be no permanent Syrian presence on the shore. Assad heard Clinton and torpedoed the summit shortly after it started. For Israel and the United States, this was proof of Hafez al-Assad's illogical intransigence, perhaps attributable to the stomach ailments and dementia from which he suffered. In the eyes of Assad, a great devotee of conspiracy theories, the summit was additional proof that the United States was just a satellite of Israel, not the other way around, and that he would never receive all of the Golan Heights or any other significant benefit from his connection with the United States. And Israel seemed weakened. Ehud Barak pulled out unconditionally from Lebanon in May 2000, which, from Assad's perspective, amounted to a humiliating defeat. To him, It proved that effective use of guerrilla warfare could force even the most powerful military force in the region to surrender. Hafez al-Assad exhorted his son Bashar to retrieve the occupied Golan Heights, but he also advised him to avoid head-on military confrontation with Israel, from which Syria almost certainly would emerge the loser. Iran, however, already had proxy terror groups, Hezbollah chief among them, waging an asymmetrical war against the Jews. Bashar al-Assad believed it was better, then, to let the radicals fight a dirty war that might force Israel into concessions. Why shed Syrian blood when the jihadists were so willing to spill their own? Assad accordingly made the link with Hezbollah and its patrons in Tehran the central component of his security doctrine. Syria and Iran signed a series of agreements on mutual defense, arms supplies, and weapons development, and Tehran gave Assad $1.5 billion to rebuild his army. Many of the top theocratic Iranians considered Assad and his Alawite brethren to be heretics, traitors to holy tradition, infidels who offended Allah. On the other hand, Syria had a strong military, a border with Israel, and more international credibility than Tehran. The Iranian government also had some problems of its own. The state was in the throes of a severe economic crisis, and there were acute rifts in Persian society and growing resentment toward the Ayatollahs. Along with North Korea and Iraq, Iran had become among the most isolated and ostracized countries in the world. In his State of the Union address in January 2002, President Bush would describe these three countries as the axis of evil. Thereafter, the American administration tightened sanctions against Iran. Bush did not include Syria in the axis of evil because the Americans still hoped it could be pulled toward the West, in part because Syria maintained friendly relations with many Western states, France and Germany in particular. "We tried to cooperate with him, Assad, against the terrorists who were fighting us in Iraq," said Michael Hayden, chief of the NSA and the CIA during the first decade of the 21st century, adding that such hopes were soon dashed. An alliance with Syria was in Iran's best interests. Tehran could offer cash, which Damascus desperately needed, and advanced military technology, such as solid-fuel rocket engines for long-range missiles. In return, Syria could provide direct access to Iran's principal adversary and, more important, a bridge to the wider world. Iranian imports and exports could be filtered through Syrian seaports and airports, lessening Iran's international isolation. At the same time, Iran was running a proxy militia in Lebanon, where Syria maintained large military and intelligence operations. To keep Hezbollah supplied and functioning, the Iranians required freedom of movement, which the Syrians could not only allow, but also facilitate. But the young Assad did more than merely choose a side. For decades, his father had been allowing the Iranians to fly shipments of arms into Damascus and then truck them overland to Hezbollah. But Hafez al-Assad assisted the Iranians only by letting them operate unencumbered. He carefully and cautiously avoided any close ties with the jihadists themselves. Bashar al-Assad, however, saw an opportunity. Hezbollah's victory over Israel and the doctrine of Hassan Nasrallah, the organization's secretary general, who likened Israel to a spider web, strong from afar but soft up close, made an impact on him. The younger Assad decided to wholeheartedly throw his lot in with both the theocrats and the jihadists, and put all of Syria's resources at their disposal. Starting in early 2002, Assad opened his own army's armories to Hezbollah, providing the organization with modern Soviet weaponry that even Iran lacked, and long-range surface-to-surface missiles. He also opened the gates of his palace to Nasrallah, whom he regarded as a role model. Syria had practical motives for wanting to strengthen Hezbollah as well. Lebanon was an economic lifeline for Syria and for Assad's generals, who enjoyed generous commissions from deals in which the state was involved. Recently, however, a number of powerful figures in Lebanon had risen and demanded that the Syrians leave. In response, Imad Mughniyeh, the Hezbollah chief of staff, began to assassinate those figures, one after another, on behalf of the Iranians and the Syrians. The assassination campaign peaked when Mughniyeh's men killed Rafiq Hariri, the most important politician in the Middle East, who had twice served as prime minister of Lebanon and had tried to mobilize the world to expel the Syrians from his country. It became clear that there was a confluence of interests among Iran, Hezbollah, and Syria, and that the three of them were uniquely suited to work together and help one another in their times of need. Thus, an alliance, which Israel's intelligence community called the Radical Front, was born. The alliance of a terrorist organization, a pariah theocracy, and a modernized nation-state allowed a sprawling network of guerrillas, self-styled revolutionaries, and criminal thugs to operate with an unusually robust level of military efficiency. The leaders of the countries and the organization developed strategy and supplied materiel for an otherwise disparate collection of operatives spread across the length and breadth of the Middle East. At the network's highest operational level were three men: Qasem Soleimani of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, Imad Mughniyeh of Hezbollah, and General Mohammed Suleiman of Syria. Islamic Jihad leader Ramadan Shalakh, who operated in Damascus under the auspices of Iran and Syria, was also brought into the alliance and invited to some of the discussions. Their lieutenants included Hassan al-Lakis, Hezbollah's R&D chief, and Mahmoud al-Majzub, the head of Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon. Hamas had no official role in the Radical Front. Sheikh Yassin, a Sunni, despised the Shiite Iranians. But Khaled Mashal, the leader of Hamas outside of Palestine, thought otherwise, and instructed one of the organization's operational commanders in Damascus, Izz al-Din al-Sheikh Khalil, to be in close contact with the other members of the front. With a web of connections and transport lines, the Radical Front began channeling more and deadlier aid for the struggle against Israel. From Beirut, Hezbollah supported and armed Palestinian terrorists, paying bonuses for each Israeli killed in suicide bombings. Rockets were dismantled in Syria or Iran, smuggled in pieces over land or by sea into the Gaza Strip, and then reassembled by Palestinian Islamic Jihad fighters. Majzub arranged to have the Revolutionary Guard ship missiles in the same manner to PIJ guerrillas in Lebanon. Mashal and Sheikh Khalil received substantial monetary assistance from Iran, perhaps without Yassin's knowledge, as well as considerable know-how that was transferred to Gaza and helped in the production of homemade rockets. Hezbollah's Lakis, meanwhile, began constructing an enormous array of bunkers and missile silos in southern Lebanon that could confront an Israeli invasion or help launch an offensive. They were camouflaged so expertly that Israeli intelligence never saw them being built. Nor was Israel fully aware of the amount of lethal hardware being assembled. By 2003, according to one assessment, Hezbollah possessed the largest arsenal ever held by a guerrilla force. Having enemies at the borders and in the occupied territories was not new for Israel, of course, but now it was surrounded by what was basically a single coordinated force: Hezbollah in Lebanon, the PIJ in the territories, Syria to the north, all funded with Iranian money and supplied with Iranian weapons. The Israeli agency responsible for gaining intel and countering such an external threat was the Mossad. But its efforts had been far from adequate, largely because it had not adapted itself to changing times. The Mossad's inability to penetrate the jihadist organizations, its lack of technological capabilities in a world where everyone has access to a cellular device and encryption software, and a series of severe operational failures, led by the botched assassination of Mashal, were all indications that the Mossad had become deficient and ineffectual. Iran was a more sophisticated and original rival than any Arab state the Mossad had tried to penetrate, and Bashar al-Assad, instituted strict field security measures in Syria as well. Here and there, the Mossad tried to thwart dangerous projects undertaken by members of the Radical Front. It learned, for example, that General Anatoly Kontsevich, a veteran of the Russian military industries, was helping Syria produce the deadliest chemical weapon, the nerve agent VX. Official protests to Moscow were ignored. So, in April 2002, Kontsevich mysteriously dropped dead on a flight from Aleppo to Moscow. But that was an isolated success. There was no consistent and steady strategy against the Radical Front, and the Israelis remained dangerously unaware of many of their adversaries' plans and actions. Compared with the successes of the Shin Bet and Amman in the occupied territories, the Mossad was considered the weak link in the intelligence community. Prime Minister Sharon was exasperated by the agency. The Mossad was too sleepy and effete for his liking, and too reluctant to take risks after its earlier operational mishaps. Mossad chief Ephraim Halevi's approach was the exact opposite of Sharon's, who always wanted to take the initiative and attack. As Dov Weissglass explained, at a time when Israel found itself in one of the most difficult battles of its life, the Second Intifada, we can never understand why that magnificent body known as the Mossad was simply non-existent. With Halevi, the diplomatic aspect was infinitely developed. The operational aspect was like an appendix to him, superfluous tissue that was dispensable. This period coincided with the peak of the Intifada, and the initial and most urgent targets on the liquidation list were those who encouraged Palestinian terrorism. Hezbollah, under Iranian control, had set up its Unit 1800 to provide the Tanzim terrorist group, established under the auspices of Arafat's Fatah, with money and training for more suicide attacks. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, in Lebanon, also supported the suicide terror activities of its members in the West Bank and Gaza with money, training, and guidance. In the absence of any strong counter-initiative on the part of the Mossad, Amman tried to fill the gap. The Mossad was not an operational partner, said Amman chief Aharon Ze'evi Farkash. On the other hand, we in Amman marked 50 Palestinians in the West Bank who, with the funding and support of Hezbollah Unit 1800 in Lebanon, were toiling all the time to produce suicide attacks. The situation had become intolerable. The idea was, therefore, to hit a number of targets in Hezbollah in order to explain to its leaders that there was a price to be paid for these actions. Colonel Ronan Cohen, the head of counterterrorism in Amman, drew up a list of targets, dubbed the 12 Musketeers, that included operatives of Unit 1800 in Hezbollah, along with a number of names from Islamic Jihad and Hamas. One of the names on the list was Qais Obeid, who once was an agent for the Shin Bet, but had defected to Hezbollah's Unit 1800. Obeid managed to lure a senior IDF reserve officer to Dubai. The officer had become enmeshed in debt, and Obeid promised to get him out of his financial troubles. He walked into a trap and was drugged, placed in a crate, and sent by diplomatic mail from the Iranian embassy in Dubai to Beirut. During his interrogation, he revealed important military secrets to Hezbollah and the Syrians. After that, Obeid, who knew a lot of Israeli Arabs and spoke fluent Hebrew, began to recruit suicide bombers. Obeid was an Israeli citizen, and there was an unwritten rule among the country's intelligence agencies that forbade killing fellow Israelis. But under the grave menace of suicide terror, this rule was suspended. Nevertheless, Cohen's list of musketeers did not include the top Hezbollah officials, Mughniyeh and his two deputies, or Secretary General Nasrallah. "We feared that this might start an all-out war," said one of the men involved in the operation. In Ze'evi Farkash and Cohen's meeting with Sharon to discuss the operation, they argued that, while the Shin Bet was doing excellent work in eliminating the highest-ranking terrorists in the West Bank and Gaza, no one was acting against the heads of the organizations providing support from outside Israel's borders. Sharon hardly needed persuasion. It's a pity that there are no initiatives like this coming from your friends, he said sourly, referring to the Mossad. The first target was Ramzi Nahara, a drug dealer and Israeli intelligence agent who had switched allegiances when Israel withdrew from Lebanon, and who was one of Obaid's colleagues in the abduction of the Israeli officer. On December 6, 2002, he was traveling with his nephew Eli Issa to their home village of Ayin Ebel in southern Lebanon. At the entrance to the village, a large explosive device camouflaged as a rock blew up as their car passed by. They were both killed. Next in line was Ali Hussein Salah, registered at the Lebanese Interior Ministry as a driver for the Iranian embassy in Beirut, but actually an operative of Unit 1800. On August 2, 2003, he was in his black BMW luxury sedan with its diplomatic license plates on his way to work at Unit 1800 headquarters in the Dahiya neighborhood of Beirut. At 8:32 a.m., a large explosive device that had been concealed in the back seat of the car detonated, ripping the car in two and hurling it 50 feet from the large crater the blast made in the road. The explosion tore Salah's body into two, one in each part of the car, Aman's report on the incident stated. After the death of Salah, Hezbollah no longer concealed his true occupation, and Al-Manar, the movement's TV station, reported, Hezbollah mourns the death of one of the greatest mujahideen, holy warriors. On July 12, 2004, Ghaleb Awali, who had replaced the slain Salah in Unit 1800, left his home in the Haret Reik Shiite neighborhood of Beirut. He entered his Mercedes and turned the key in the ignition. Seconds later, the car exploded. He was severely wounded and rushed to the hospital, but pronounced dead on arrival. A new group, making its first and last appearance in Lebanon, took responsibility for the killing. Calling itself Jund al-Sham, Soldiers of the Levant, the Sunni group declared, "We have executed one of the symbols of treachery, the Shiite Ghaleb Awali." Hezbollah had no doubt that this was an Israeli disinformation stunt and that Israel was behind the assassination. In his eulogy at the magnificent funeral staged for Awali, Hassan Nasrallah noted that the deceased had belonged to a special unit dedicated to supporting the Palestinians' struggle. "He is a shaheed on our way to Palestine, a shaheed for Jerusalem and the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the confrontation with the Zionist entity," Nasrallah declared over Awali's coffin, draped in the yellow Hezbollah flag. He accused Amman commander Ze'evi Farkash of being responsible for the killing. Sharon was appreciative of Ze'evi Farkash's efforts, but he realized that more was needed to counter the radical front, and that radical change within the Mossad was necessary. Sharon wanted Halevi replaced, and several names, including Mossad veterans and IDF generals, were suggested. But Sharon really had only one person in mind, Meir Dagan, his good friend who had served under him in the army. Dagan was tough and aggressive, exactly the kind of person Sharon needed to fight back against the radical front. Dagan had left the IDF in 1995 and later became the head of the Counterterrorism Bureau at the Prime Minister's office. In that capacity, he'd set up a clandestine body called SPEAR, aimed at disrupting the enemy's financial resources. I attributed great importance to the economic warfare that had to be an integral part of our campaign against our main adversary, said Dagan. Spear's investigations led Israel to outlaw all organizations that held funds on behalf of Hamas, some of them coming from wealthy Muslims abroad. Spear also urged the FBI and its European counterparts to do the same in their respective countries, but this was before 9/11. And their warnings fell upon deaf ears. At one meeting, the contrast in style between Dagan's and Halevi's Mossad was apparent. The Mossad presented information indicating that some of the money provided by Iran to Hamas was channeled through a European bank headquartered in Zurich. "No problem," said Dagan. "Let's burn it." "Burn what?" "The bank, of course," Dagan replied. "We have the address, no?" The participants explained that it wasn't a matter of cash, but but of electronic transfers through SWIFT, which were backed up elsewhere. So what? Dagon said. Let's burn